Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event, from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to your favorite Saturday morning show exclusively here on WEEB. I am Steve Woodward. My co-host David Hensley is out this week taking care of important international affairs, no doubt. But he will join us again next time. But we are going to forge ahead, as we always do, with plenty of material. Show prep was rigorous and extensive this week. We want to start off by thanking our sponsor, the Marketplace Restaurant and Catering, and our friend Luke Black. They've been doing what they do since 1980. Check them out for breakfast and lunch, and of course, any catering, professional catering services that you may require, they can handle it with ease, and the food is delicious. That's important, too. Coming up later in the program, we are going to have a wide-ranging conversation with North Carolina native J.D. Hayworth. I guess you might call him the original J.D. We now have J.D. Vance as vice president. J.D. Hayworth was a student body president at NC State way back in 1979. He later found himself working as a sportscaster in Arizona. And in 1994, he ran for Congress. And he came in with the Newt Gingrich Congress of 1994-95, and the Contract with America. He was part of a very consequential and pivotal moment in American history, and we will talk to him later on in the program. So you've been watching this week the unraveling of what used to be the bulletproof narrative that there was no fingerprints on the Russian collusion that was the driving narrative when Donald Trump was running for president the first time back in 2016. That was all, as the media told us at the time, that whole Russian collusion narrative was rooted in fact, in truth. In fact, Trump was up to his eyeballs with Vladimir Putin and fiercely loyal to the murderous Putin, and might as well have been a surrogate of a foreign country. And all those in Trump's orbit were equally guilty, and many of them were targeted and taken out as a result. But of course, here we are a decade later, and now we know that, in fact, the Russian collusion narrative was explicitly and strategically created by the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign with the full support and strategic guidance of then-President Barack Obama and all the folks in the all of the president's men, Brennan, James Clapper, John Brennan, FBI Director James Comey, and so on and so forth. All these people, reminiscent of the Watergate era, but what they were involved with makes Watergate look like a minor shoplifting offense. So what's going to happen? Well, what needs to happen is these people need to be brought in before Congress to testify. They need to be forced to explain to the American people their efforts to derail the presidential campaign of Donald J. Trump, and then when that failed, to diminish and derail his first years in office by charging those in his orbit, people like George, I'm drawing a blank on the guy, Carter Page, for sure, and others, Peter Navarro, Steve Bannon, etc., who ultimately would go to prison. But in those early years, it was especially General Michael Flynn who was a fall guy for the false narrative of Russian interference driven by Trump's allegiance to Putin. We now know that there was no such allegiance, that in fact it was a political strategy concocted by Team Clinton. So what needs to happen? Well, we turn for guidance on that to a retired CIA operations director and intel analyst named Sam Faddis. Play clip one.
Well, it had to be awareness going down the ranks a bit. What's the exact number? I don't know. Does that mean the entire organization was in on it? Not what I'm saying. But you're not going to find that two people at the top did all this all by themselves. That's not the way this functioned. And that will, I think, be to the benefit of people like Tulsi Gabbard and now the DOJ, because what you'll find is that there are, I don't know, a couple of dozen folks anyway who were on the inside of this, and some of them will now realize what they were on the inside of, and it'll be time to jump ship, right? Which is what you need to prosecute this. What do we need? We need accountability, which is what everybody in MAGA asks for all day, every day, right? You can't charge John Brennan with perjury, which, and, you know, a misdemeanor charge, give him a traffic ticket. People have to be charged, tried, convicted, go to prison for felony level offenses. We need to, this was an ongoing conspiracy and an attempted coup, and it has to be dealt with as such.
I could not agree with that distillation of the situation more than what Mr. Faddis said there. Gosh, you know, this is such an opportunity for the Attorney General Pam Bondi and for NSI Director Tulsi Gabbard and for Kash Patel and FBI Director John Ratcliffe to prove themselves worthy of President Trump's trust, to be pivotal figures in exposing one of the great scandals in American history. And we can only we're not going to hope. Hope is not a strategy. We're going to pray that that they have the fortitude to see this through. You know, every week, and I kind of jumped the gun, but that's okay. Every week we do like to identify our public enemy number one. I was just too excited to get to the Sam Faddis sound that I couldn't help myself. But I did pick a public enemy number one this week, and it's actually an entity, not a person. It is of all places, a otherwise obscure New Hampshire abortion clinic called the Lovering Health Center. If you know that if it's called a health center, there's probably bad stuff going on inside the doors. So what are they doing up there? Well, they have hijacked the American Girl doll. Remember those? Even as old as I am, my daughter back in her childhood was a fan of the American Girl dolls. This abortion clinic has hijacked the American Girl dolls as a means of indoctrinating girls about everything from sex change operations to birth control. And I'm not making it up. I wish I could say otherwise. Their posts on social media depicted five American Girl dolls of different races, each engaged in what you could only describe as troubling behavior. One American Girl doll was depicted as being on hormone replacement therapy, ladies and gentlemen, a medical regimen for those looking to transition. Of course, what American Girl doll doesn't want to do that? Another was shown being on pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is the medical regimen that helps reduce the risk of contracting HIV for the sexually active. Boy, what a lovely lesson to give to these young girls. A third doll was featured receiving a routine STI screening, A fourth was on birth control, of course. And a final one was having a medication abortion. We are still waiting to see what the blowback is going to be on this abortion clinic. And something tells me, I'm just guessing here, but something tells me that this they didn't get this idea on their own. I think we're going to find that maybe this is more rampant and occurring in more than one of these abortion clinics, that there may be a broader movement behind this. And public enemy number one, it was a no-brainer this week, the hijacking of the American Girl dolls. Now, not a week goes by that we don't get hit with one or more new data points that blow our minds in the age of Trump. And this one came to us, believe it or not, from CNN this week. It has now been established that in this year before us, 2025, the United States will achieve net negative migration into our homeland. And this will be for the first time in a half century, about 50 years. This is an incredible result, not totally unexpected, given that we have secured the southern border in ways that, you know, we were told were not possible by previous regimes. And we are now not only patrolling the border, but we are sending the signal around the world that the dinner bell is no longer ringing. Don't bother to line up and come here from everywhere, from all corners of the earth. Let's play clip two.
How about net migration in the United States? Get this. It's down. It's going to be down at least 60%. We may be dealing with, get this, negative net migration to the United States in 2025. That will be the first time there is negative net migration in this country in at least 50 years. We're talking about down from 2.8 million in 2024. So Donald Trump has always run on tariffs, and he's run on a hawkish line on immigration. And on both of those issues, we are seeing record high tariff rates for this century going all the way back, well back into the early part of the 20th century. And when it comes to immigration, net migration, we are seeing record low levels, way down from where we were during the Biden administration. We are potentially looking at negative net migration for the first time in at least 50 years.
Now, before the left goes crazy and lights their heads on their hair on fire, or their heads, either one, some of them are bald, before they go completely ballistic on us here, yes, I think taking a pause in migration at this point in our history is probably a good thing. Now, we are a nation of immigrants. I get that. And we should encourage legal, with an L, legal migration into this country. And we have a long and rich history of giving people from other countries opportunities to excel and live the American dream. We have given more opportunity and lifted more people out of poverty and in some cases into wealth than any country in the history of the world. But this little pause in migration is not going to undo that legacy in any way, shape, or form. So calm down out there on the radical left, please. Want to remind you that coming up a little later in the big show today, we will be talking to former U.S. Congressman J.D. Hayworth, a North Carolina native who was a multi-term member of the U.S. House representing Arizona between 1995 and 2007. And now he is a national spokesperson for a big pharma prescription drug reform, price reform especially. And we'll be talking to him about that and other topics coming up in just a short while from now. Well, what says fun like watching French leader Macron and his lovely wife Brigitte in a bit of a pickle, you might say. What am I talking about? Well, there is a investigative journalist, Candace Owens. An acquired taste, a bit brash for some, a bit obnoxious, some might even say, but she is a bulldog. And when she sinks her talons into a story, she generally comes away with ripping away the darkness and shedding the light on what's really going on. In this particular case, Candace recently sat down with Tucker Carlson for one of his long-form conversations. They usually go on about 2 hours, and they're usually very interesting because the subjects are interesting, the people. Candace, her name came up when Macron, the French president, and others were visiting the White House earlier this year to discuss jointly how they could all work together to bring an end to the Russia-Ukraine war, obviously driven by Russia's invasion of Ukraine at the outset. And during that summit at the White House, French President Macron got Donald Trump off to the side. And he had a little request for him because he was concerned. Candace Owens has been working on a story which basically boils down to this. In her youth, the president's wife, Brigitte, was not a woman, but in fact was a guy. And in fact, when she met Macron, he was just a teenage boy. She's about 25 years older than he is. Which is creepy unto itself. But she was a transitioning male even then when they met. Well, Candace Owens has gotten all over this story and has worked on it tirelessly because, you know, she thinks, hey, you know, if one of the leaders of the world is keeping a lid on something that's kind of important, maybe we need to know about it. She tells the story. Play clip three.
So I was called by Trump in February. Emmanuel Macron had visited Trump, and I had done this series about, it was about his wife, Brigitte Macron. And the series got a lot of views, and Emmanuel Macron personally flew to D.C. and asked Trump to ask me to shut up, to just stop speaking about his wife. And I
did
was,
you know this was going to rise to the level of international incident?
No. And it's actually making me go back. And historically, I'm thinking, you know, all the times we were told that a war ended because of this or because of that. If this was one element of negotiation of Emmanuel Macron to Trump and the topic of why he was, you know, ostensibly there was to discuss the end of the Ukrainian and Russian war, but you're taking Trump aside and you're asking him to shut up this podcaster in the U.S., I'm wondering if anything that we're told in our history books is real.
Good question. Good question. Can you imagine that the affairs of Macron and his wife could somehow compromise the efforts to end a war? I mean, I hate to think about that, but I think she raises a valid point, and we're gonna keep an eye on this story because you know it's a little bit of a you know, kind of a gossipy sort of Dominic Dunn kind of, you know, celebrities in hot water kind of story. But, hey, he's the president of France. So, you know, what can I tell you? In the time we have remaining and before we get to our conversation with J.D. Hayworth of Arizona, the North Carolina native who went on to become, after graduating from NC State, went on to become a sports anchor in Arizona, and then a member of Congress. We'll be talking to him later. I wanted to also share a story that came out this past week involving former Governor Roy Cooper and sitting Governor Josh Stein here in North Carolina, two of the least motivational, inspiring people that I can think of on the political scene, both in this state and around the country. You may have heard of Laura Loomer. Do you notice how we're more and more referencing these independent journalists. Do you notice how people like the network anchors, the Anderson Coopers, and these others are not really in the conversation anymore? That we now need to rely on these independent journalists to tell us what's actually going on and to reveal things that the left media would just as soon not have us know about. So Laura Loomer, she is a confidant of the Trump White House. That's makes the left crazy. And she's an independent journalist. I suggest you follow her on all the social media platforms. It's L-O-O-M-E-R, Loomer. Here's what she discovered. And I'll just read her report. Democrats have scrubbed Roy Cooper's Twitter X account, which is the handle is at NC Governor. They have scrubbed that to hide his radical record as governor of North Carolina now that he's running for U.S. Senate. In what Loomer calls an unprecedented and deceptive move to hide a Senate candidate's history of radical left policies for 8 years, the Democrats and at Roy Cooper NC changed the bio name of his old X account from his time as governor to pretend that his old tweets are now statements that were made by sitting governor Josh Stein. This raises questions about the ethics of not preserving official government communications. Most government accounts are archived, and when new administrations come in, they create new social media handles. How is Roy Cooper supposed to be held accountable for his 8-year radical record as governor if none of his old tweets can be attributed to him? It's a good question. For example, back in June 2018, Roy Cooper, then governor, hopped on his Twitter account to blast President Trump's secure border policies. This was in the first Trump term at the southern border. Cooper ordered the recall of North Carolina National Guard members from their border duties. Can you imagine that? Defying the will of a sitting president who's trying to clean up a very dangerous open border by bringing your National Guard home? I mean, I guess if he'd had a legitimate reason to do it, like a natural disaster, which we do have the occasional hurricane, and of course Hurricane Helene last September as an example. But nonetheless, in this particular case, he just did it to stick a thumb in Trump's eye. Fast forward to today, writes Loomer, and that very same Twitter handle, I'm going to call it Twitter because X, I can't get used to that. Everybody knows it's Twitter. That very same Twitter handle has undergone a full makeover and extreme sanitization in a calculated move by the Democrats to make it seem like Roy Cooper's governor handle doesn't exist anymore. It's really quite blatant when you think about it. But, of course, we know what his record is. And we know, for example, when the annual rating of best states for business expansion comes out, and North Carolina is usually number one, as they are this year, and I think last year they were number two behind Virginia. And what happens? The governors always say, oh, hey, look at us. Look at us. What a great job we're doing. North Carolina is number one, never minding that it's the low cost of living and the and the tax rates, which the Republican legislature has blessed us with, that makes us an attractive place to do business. They never bring that up, of course, because, oh, well, you know, that would be a little inconvenient, shall we say. One of the other stories I wanted to share with you, because it's just too good to ignore. There's a strategic plan floating around, which is intended to guide North Carolina public schools over the next 5 years between now and 2030. It is a product of the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction. The plan pledges to elevate teaching and learning by doing what? Not just improving the teaching and the learning, but by, here it comes, targeting academically advanced students while directing more resources to immigrant and newcomer students. I'm not making this up. Their plan calls for a decrease in disproportional identification of exceptional children and academically intellectually gifted programs. Okay, so in other words, why would we want to recognize the academically gifted? That's not fair to the others. How are we going to improve our overall education if we've got too many smart kids being recognized? Then they're going to increase the percentage of multilingual learners by giving them opportunities for academic growth and proficiency. And they're going to strive to increase enrollment of underrepresented students in specialized academic enrichment opportunities. Oh boy. Including, here it comes, advanced coursework and governor's school participation. Now, governor's school, again, is a very prestigious acknowledgement of a student's academic prowess. But what they want to do is they want to get more underrepresented students in the governor's school, regardless of whether they're eligible for the governor's school. And I'm not making it up. I keep saying that, and I have to keep saying it. As we've been telling you this morning, we're happy to be joined now by our guest, J.D. Hayworth, the former congressman from Arizona, but a North Carolina native and 1980 graduate of NC State. Good morning, J.D.
Well, good morning, Steve. It's great to be with you on WEEB. For all my friends in the Sand Hills and Moore County and beyond, we're going to offer a little more to them on our program today.
We certainly are. Hey, what we have to talk about off the top is your path to the halls of Congress during a very consequential time in American history. You're working here in this state as a sportscaster, and you've been doing that for several years. How did you end up being a sportscaster in North Carolina, and then ultimately a member of the U.S. House?
Well, thereby hangs a tale, and I'll try to avoid that Ted Knight is Ted Baxter thing on the Mary Tyler Moore show.
Right.
It all began at a little 5,000-watt radio station. Actually, it began at a stereo 100,000-watt station in High Point. I was fortunate enough to pass my third-class radio telephone license with the broadcast endorsement. And so I started working in radio at age 14. Wow. And my football coaches, their favorite epithet that I can repeat on the air here on a family-friendly show is, "You such and such disc jockey." But anyway, I go down to NC State, double major in speech communication and political science, obviously speech for broadcasting, and political science for my passion, recruited as right tackle, ended up left out, and we'll just leave the physical challenges I had in football behind. But by my senior year, I had been elected student body president, and at that time, I believe I was the lone Republican on the NC State Board of Trustees. So that was a very interesting time as another straight state grad was transitioning to governor after Jim Holzhauser's time. Obviously, Jim Hunt was governor, and so his appointees were coming up. But it was an interesting experience, and certainly I'm no stranger to North Carolina politics, but here today, obviously, to talk about policy and my role as spokesman for the Pharmaceutical Reform Alliance. And I just thank you so much for the invitation, Steve.
Absolutely. So you're working as a sports anchor in Phoenix, right? In 1994-ish,
and that's right.
And then suddenly you're running for Congress, and you pulled it off, and it brings to mind a somewhat famous American named Ronald Reagan, who sort of made a similar transition.
That's right. In fact, in every prospective candidate, probably when they should be spending time in the district they want to represent. In the old days, a lot of us before the internet and email and stuff, we would actually go to Washington. And so in the lead up to the 94 campaign, I was back visiting with two of the prognosticators of the time, Charlie Cook and Stu Rothenberg. And we had a nice, I guess, about an hour session. At the end, Stu asks, well, Mr. Hayworth, can you cite any other sportscaster who went on to political success? And I said, well, Stu, this is a joke, right? I said, because do you remember the name Reagan? And obviously he began as a sportscaster, got in the movies, and then became governor of California and, of course, president of the United States. But it was a nice way to transition in. And also, I would be remiss, Steve, if I didn't. I know that WEEB is the station flag for Duke athletics. But not only as a state guy, since my mom went to Duke, this is going to be really weird. Carolina alums, make sure you have both hands on the wheel. I'm actually going to thank my mentor, one of my mentors in the business, the late, great Woody Durham, who hired me actually during my senior year to fill in for him at Channel 28 in Raleigh-Durham, which was then WPTF-TV, which was then the NBC affiliate. And it's kind of analogous to baseball, Steve. For me, it was Raleigh-Durham to Greenville, Spartanburg, Asheville, to Cincinnati, and then in 1987 to Phoenix. And Phoenix is where I met my bride, Miss Mary, and we started our family. And I'll tell you, it was something. We stepped out in faith because, you know, I had really achieved a lot professionally, coming to a major market and being the weeknight sports anchor and spring training voice of the Chicago Cubs here during Cactus League play on the radio back in those days. Mm-hmm. It was obvious that the new seat at the time needed new representation. A Democrat had won the seat, and she had voted for Bill Clinton's then largest tax increase in American history. So we started making plans to run, and we found out we were going to have another little one. I told my wife, we'll just step away from this. She said, no, I want you to run. And Miss Mary's vote of confidence at a trepidatious time, if you will, was something that that worked out, and we were able to make history as part of the first Republican majority of my lifetime. Because in 1994, I was 36. The Democrats had been in charge on Capitol Hill in the House for 40 long years. And we were able to make some changes, I think changes for the better, replacing welfare with work, a work requirement, balancing four, count them, four successive budgets with a nudist speaker. And of course, given the pendulum of American politics, when the country decided to turn leftward, things changed. And that's why we have a Republican majority now, however narrow, and a president of the United States who understands action in the executive. And that's what we're seeing right now.
So you mentioned the balanced budget, which today the concept of that seems almost unfathomable to most Americans on both sides of the aisle, unfortunately. But you're now focused on another area that is in dire need of reform, and that is the American consumers, I guess you might say, relationship to or enslavement by the big pharma industry. What is your work in that regard?
Well, you know, the folks at Pharmaceutical Reform Alliance, and by the way, if your listeners want to find out more, the website is pharma, with a PH, pharmareformalliance.com. They said to me, JD, you've got a reputation as a tell-it-like-it-is guy. You know, I had a few dust-ups with George W. Bush when he was president over what he called comprehensive immigration reform, and the rest of us knew to be amnesty. Right. They said, you tell it like it is. We want you to come along and talk about big pharma. So I have the perspective from the inside as a member of Congress, as the first Arizonan in history to serve on the Ways and Means Committee, controlling the tax code and dealing with a lot of health care, Medicare, Medicaid, part of the jurisdiction of Ways and Means. So seeing it from the inside and now seeing it again from the outside as you trade in the title congressman for a much more honorable description, citizen. And I will tell you, fellow citizens, we are paying on average three times for our prescription drugs what the rest of the world is paying. That's not right. And the good news is this is not a Republican issue or a Democrat or vegetarian issue. This is an American issue. Steve, the phenomenal thing is we all seem to get it. You and I have heard about how polarized we are, how we're not talking to each other. Well, the Kaiser Family Foundation in 2024, right before the big election, polled Americans, and listen to this, 89% of Republicans, 84% of Democrats, and 78, almost 80% of independents responded that Big Pharma is more focused on profits. And recent polling we've done by the Pharmaceutical Reform Alliance indicates that fully 84% of Americans say the reason we are paying inflated prices is because of Big Pharma. And what's more, for those who aspire to serve in Congress or want to keep their seats in Congress, it's worth noting that our polling shows 86% of Americans want a member of Congress willing to stand up to Big Pharma. And so we at the Pharmaceutical Reform Alliance, in a nonpartisan way, are saying, hey, this is the major problem. The good news, of course, is that President Trump sees it loudly and clearly, and like Theodore Roosevelt, he's not afraid to use the White House as a bully pulpit. Last day of July, he writes a letter to the CEOs of the major drug companies, what we call Big Pharma. And just 2 days ago, the CEO at Pfizer confirmed that his company is in negotiations with the administration. But listen to what he said. He said, oh, yeah, we're engaging in a productive way to find a solution. But then he said the contents of the president's letter trying to bring down these unfair prices on America, he said the contents of the letter are a big ask. Now, stop and think about that for a second, Steve. We haven't been asked. We've basically been told by Big Pharma, you will pay three times as much as prescription drug patients in the rest of the developed world. And, oh, yeah, by the way, through your tax dollars, you'll pay for a big chunk of our research and development. And so you got that going. The other thing, Steve, just keep this in mind. Everybody knows that Donald Trump is not opposed to profits. He is opposed to profiteering. Mm-hmm. And what's going on with Big Pharma? Their profit margins come in at like at 76%. It's twice as big as the average profit margin on the S&P 500. Something's wrong with that picture, and those listening to our conversation know something's wrong in terms of what they're having to pay for prescription drugs, and that's why the president's step here, and also flipping the script on most favored nation status. When I was in Congress, we'd debate, well, are we going to extend that to the Chinese? By the way, I was a vote against that, one of a handful of Republicans on the Ways and Means Committee then a couple of decades ago saying, no, China is not using economics for good and for peaceful purposes, but part of basically economic warfare. But now the president's flipped the script saying, look, all you need to know is let's make the United States of America the most favored nation status. To make America healthy again, let's put America first again. And that's the thinking behind the proposal of most favored nation status, and I hope my old colleagues on Ways and Means will get to work on that legislation pronto.
I think one of the big stories of the past week that was largely overlooked, but along these same lines, was the Department of Health and Human Services and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. canceling 22 contracts related to additional mRNA vaccine development, which is, potentially the death knell for these not safe and not effective jabs that we have been putting up with for the past 5 years. I thought that was a big development, but I want to keep moving forward because we've got a lot to talk about in this age of Trump. Never a day without headlines. Capitol Hill right now is a place that and the Trump administration, I think they need to coordinate their efforts here, just as you witnessed the Bill Clinton era and the Starr report that rocked Washington, D.C., and didn't take Clinton down, but certainly, I think, tainted his legacy quite a bit. Now we have the revelations about the Russian hoax and who the hoaxsters actually were, and we've got an opportunity to, you know, expose another Clinton, Hillary, and her campaign. How do you see that playing out right now?
Well, I will tell you that the irony of, you mentioned the Clintons, and of course the defense of the media. Oh, this is old news, and they'll extend their so-called pardon of the press to Obama and a whole lot of bad actors. But here's the point, since you referenced this in terms of my time in Congress, there were times when when Bill Clinton tried to basically trade on the popularity and the reform of what we were doing. For example, our contract with America, where we brought up 10 common sense pieces of legislation that, by the way, like reform of Big Pharma, were polling at 80%. And, of course, Clinton would say, these old Republicans with their contract on America. And then he'd stand up and take credit for our legislative stuff because, after all, he was president. He had to sign it in the law. So he tried to have it both ways. Later, he had his problems. And I'm not asking anyone to excuse some real constitutional problems that it is important for the body politic to deal with. But I am saying that just as Bill Clinton had to embrace the welfare reform that we kept bringing up in time after time, and in 1996, before that presidential election, Dick Morris, who was then with Clinton and then came back over, of course, he had a career also helping our dear friend Jesse Helms. Mm-hmm. Through the years, he was able to consult on both sides of the aisle, and later we worked together at Newsmax TV. Dick would tell the story. We sent that up in 96 three times, and he told Clinton, Mr. President, people may not understand the ins and outs of all the economic implications, but they understand baseball. This is the third time it's been sent up. This is an issue the American people want to see, welfare reform that involves work. You need to sign this bill. So he did so. Now, why do I mention that? The script is a little different this time. We have a president who's opposed by the media and a very energized minority within the minority party, kind of controlling things on the left, but in the final analysis, to win election in the people's house, to continue to do business for the one-third of the Senate that's going to be up in these upcoming midterms in 2026, people want to see results. And even with all the press conferences and social media and television shows, far from the roar of the grease paint, the smell of the crowd, you've got bipartisan legislation to enact the type of reforms we need to lower prescription drug prices. So, just like my time in Congress, as Mark Twain said, Steve, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. Mm-hmm. Even at a time that seems to be the most polarized, with an election on the horizon, with the American people wanting to hold Big Pharma accountable, I believe there will be a breakthrough. The American people are demanding it. And this is something where on policy, even in the face of rather contentious politics and, dare I say, constitutional issues, this is something that can get done. It happened with us in 96. I think it can happen again in 2026.
Well, to your point, getting something done does seem to be a challenge for both sides of the aisle in Washington. And, you know, Trump moves a million miles a minute, but then ultimately we have to wait on the process. And, you know, you've got, for example, in the U.S. Senate, you know, they should have stayed and gotten these appointments jammed through that were still waiting on. All of Trump's appointments, they're being held up. Instead, they take their recess. So it's like business as usual. But that's life in the swamp, I guess. You mentioned 26, and we've got a race brewing here in North Carolina for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by Tom Tillis, featuring two what I would call not marquee names. Former Governor Roy Cooper, the Democrat, a two-term governor, who, like you referenced earlier, every time North Carolina is named the number one or number two state in the country for business expansion, Cooper takes the credit for the Republican policies that make it possible. He's running for Senate as the Democrat. And then we've got RNC Chair Michael Whatley, who is Trump-endorsed, but certainly not very well-known outside of those who are other than the inside baseball political people, I guess I would say. What is your take on that race? I mean, it's probably going to be maybe the most expensive Senate race in history.
Well, some who are eager, those pundits and some who claim to be Republicans, are saying, now look at what they've done with Tillis retiring. They're going to hand this seat to Roy Cooper, a popular former governor. Look at the money Cooper raised. Wait a minute. Don't forget what happens. All I could say is, here's a challenge from my friends at the Charlotte Observer, the Raleigh News Observer, the Greensboro Daily News, and the paper of your choice, if you still subscribe. Why don't you go check on some of the funding mechanisms that have been used by the left in recent years, and I'll leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, Chairman Whatley now has a chance, especially given his relationship with President Trump, to adopt the MAGA agenda, to say, here's what we're going to get done, and quite frankly, here is the issue. Reform of big pharma and cutting prescription drug prices. Now, he seizes an activist conservative agenda and reminds people of the real Roy Cooper record, where I was shocked as a native North Carolinian to see him out in the days of the woke protests in the street, marching around the state capitol, I guess down by the governor's mansion, with those who were excused from committing crimes because they were crimes against property, allegedly, rather than people. I believe those were the words of the Raleigh police chief at the time.
Mm-hmm.
What are you talking about? Crime is crime. People own property. And when you destroy the property, you're hurting the lives and the livelihood of the law-abiding. I think if Chairman Whatley draws that contrast and reminds people of the real radical Roy Cooper, and, you know, it goes back to the COVID thing. I mean, we heard about Cuomo in New York letting those patients with COVID back in retirement centers. My dear dad was in a retirement center. He lost his life to COVID, and much the same thing was going on in North Carolina, but the press gives Roy a pass. It is up to Republicans and Chairman Whatley to draw a contrast. And since Donald Trump has been successful in his electoral outings in the old North State, my advice for Chairman Whatley is to work hard with the Trump administration, adopt this activist conservative reform and this common sense nonpartisan big pharma reform in terms of lowering prescription drug prices, and that's the way we have another Republican in the United States Senate from North Carolina.
I hope we see that. I think it's going to be a contentious race. It's really, we're already starting to hear the sniping and and the conceived ads and social media posts and all those things. But it's going to be a long march to the 26 midterms, I fear. But
again, here's the positive issue.
Right.
And indeed, Chairman Whatley can put out a contract with North Carolina, and he can take those issues where Roy embraced radical, wrong-headed ideas, and he can offer a positive contrast. Now, you're never going to eliminate the sniping in a campaign, but again, when 80%, when almost 90% want a member of Congress, and dare I say a United States senator, they'll stand up to Big Pharma. Well, then Chairman Whatley needs to embrace this agenda to become Senator Whatley. And I would just strongly recommend it to him. And I think that will be a help to him on the trail because, again, our success in 94 wasn't as Republicans per se. It was because of what we were able to do in terms of offering a common sense positive agenda. And that will flummox Roy Cooper and those in the media who seek to always excuse him or somehow lionize or, dare I say, canonize the ex-governor. And really, all you got to do is go back and show that the day after that abysmal debate, there was Roy Cooper playing the game that somehow Joe Biden was a competent chief executive. I mean, that stuff is really going to give North Carolina voters pause. In fact, Steve, the only warning I have is I understand that North Carolina's Department of Motor Vehicles was taking a look at Arizona for, quote, reforms. Don't do that.
Okay.
That's where you're going to have electoral hijinks.
Yeah.
Now, I understand the state auditor is saying, look, we got to find reforms, but I'm going to tell you, the left, when things get contentious, that's when we start to see hijinks.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be diplomatic and leave it at that. And certainly we've gone through that in the state of Arizona. I don't want to see that for my native state of North Carolina.
Well, J.D. Hayworth, we want to thank you very much for being a part of today's show. And I know that you are a very content Carizonan living out there in the desert west, but If your travels bring you back here to the Tar Heel State and through Moore County, we'd love to have you live sometime and take you out on one of our beautiful golf courses here and spend some time with you as we have this morning. But we do thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you. And given all the courses out here in Scottsdale, I still hear from a lot of good friends. Hey, I was in Pinehurst. I got to play Pinehurst number two, and though for purposes of full disclosure, I'm not a golfer. I do enjoy the 19th hole, however.
Yes.
Pinehurst is a remarkable place, and you live in a special part of the world, and I do hope to get home, but right now some of our Carizonans, we're going to get together the last Thursday of the month. One of my pals down the street here is an ECU alum, so that opener, the Pirates against the Wolfpack in Raleigh, going to be a little contentious.
Yes.
That's a little slice of home, and I do hope to get back sometime during the football season. And God bless you, Steve, for letting me do this radio homecoming with you in the Sand Hills and in Moore County.
You are very welcome, sir. Have a great day.
You too. Take care.
It is always such a pleasure to have guests like J.D. Hayworth joining us here on the program with his insights and his, his contextual view of what's going on in the present in the swamp based on what he experienced back in the 90s and early 2000s. Well, would you look at the time? It's happened once again. We've run out of it. I want to thank our sponsor, the Marketplace Restaurant and Catering. We are here each and every Saturday at 11 a.m. exclusively on WEEB. I'm Steve Woodward, and my co-host David Hensley will be back next week when we will be taking aim.